Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Holy Cross Church versus Wood.
May it please the court, Ms. Susan Hayes will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Holy Cross Church of God in Christ took out a $140,000 mortgage on its property. The FDIC acquired the assets of its lender bank, sorted through the notes, and eventually sold the note in a bulk sale. At that time, the taxpayers got their money and the note entered the private marketplace. So what's before the court today is an ordinary note accelerated by an ordinary private party. A few aftermarket sales later, Mr. Wolf purchased the note for $5,000 plus a commission. And that leads to the court the question before it, whether an assignee of an assignee of an assignee of a note that happened to once be owned by the FDIC gets the benefit of the extended limitations period granted by FREA.
Well, don't we have a preliminary issue?
We do.
To determine which one of the two statutes of limitations apply?
Yes.
Because it does make a difference on what the accrual date of the action is, isn't that correct?
The question in this case, or the question the Tyler Court of Appeals raised, was whether it ever accrued at all.
I understand it.
Right.
But either way, whether you answer that question yes or no, what statute applies, first you have to decide whether there was an accrual date and when it was. Do I understand from the facts that there was never a suit or a claim on the note itself involved in this litigation by Mr. Wolf, and that all that we have is his foreclosure and the church's opposition to the foreclosure itself as being barred by limitations. Is that correct?
That's correct. The church obtained a TRO barring foreclosure the morning it was set.
So there's no deficiency or anything about the note per se involved. So the preliminary question is, how do we determine the accrual rate?
The claim Mr. Wolf's seeking to pursue is foreclosure on the note.
Yes.
To foreclose a note, you must accelerate it first.
Yes.
And in the record is an affidavit from the attorney who accelerated the note in 1994, stating that he did so accelerate it and proving up copies of the notice of acceleration and notices of foreclosure.
I understand. And the Tyler Court treated what appears to be in the papers, the motion for summary judgment and the response, that the operative date of August 15, 1994, which is the date of the letter that says we're exercising our right to accelerate, as a legal question rather than a fact question.
It did, and I believe that the Tyler Court of Appeals was incorrect in even reaching that question. In the summary judgment procedure, the parties expressly agreed as to the date of acceleration. And Rule 166AC in this court's precedent bar the appellate courts from going behind parties' agreements to narrow the issues at summary judgment.
I understand that, but does that answer the question, were they right in saying, well, it's a question of law rather than a question of fact, so we're not bound by the August 15th, 1994 date? Does it make any difference?
It's what Tyler didn't do a very good job of was breaking down what it meant by that. Whether the question of accrual is a question of law. The question of law applicable here is that acceleration amounts to accrual under the statute. And the case law in Texas is such that if you have an unequivocal declaration of acceleration followed by an affirmative step to enforce that declaration, then you have acceleration.
Well, why do you have to have affirmative action to effectuate an acceleration in the context of accelerating the note itself? Does that mean you have to sue on the note?
No. And that's exactly what Tyler, I think, thought Holy Cross should have done.
But they never sued.
No.
Holy Cross didn't own the note. Mr. Wolf owned the note.
Well, the Court of Appeals confused the facts necessary for foreclosure with the facts necessary for acceleration. Holy Cross moved for summary judgment under Section 16035B of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code. That sets the limitations period between accrual and foreclosure. And there's a sentence in the Court of Appeals opinion criticizing Holy Cross for not showing any evidence that foreclosure ever occurred. Well, of course the church didn't. That's not the applicable limitations period. Had this been a suit on a deficiency after foreclosure, that would have been the applicable fact for accrual.
So it's your position that August 15th date is the operative date for a court to answer the legal question, is that the accrual date?
Exactly.
And then having said that, if it is, where do we go from there?
Where we go from there is which statute applies, the federal or the state. And the state applies here.
Well, what about the part where they say, and you have to have affirmative action to foreclose to make that August 15th date an operative date?
The law in the state is not affirmative action to foreclose. It's affirmative action toward enforcing that acceleration. And a notice of foreclosure is sufficient. And the record also includes
a notice.
Well,
why do you have to have that anyway? What bothers me is if it's accelerated, if the owner of the note does absolutely nothing for more than 4 years, it would seem, if it's accelerated, that they're out of court on both the note and the right to foreclose.
I think where the confusion in the courts of appeals opinion comes from is some of this case law is pretty old. It dates back.
Well, they cited about six or seven cases to support their holding that was a requirement.
So,
to effectuate acceleration, you had to do something to foreclose.
Right. I think the cases Tyler relied on was relying on very old cases that date from a time when real estate practitioners didn't regularly send out a clear-cut notice of acceleration. Cases that predate this court's decision in Ogden. And in those cases, you had a statement by a creditor that wasn't clear if they were really accelerating or only accelerating if you don't pay me in 2 weeks.
All
those
right.
kinds of notices.
Okay.
And that's where the courts were wanting an affirmative step.
Well, let's assume for your argument then that since both parties agreed that August 15th was an operative date for some purpose,
mm-hmm.
and then we apply the law, why doesn't Mr. Wolf get the benefit of the six-year statute instead of the four-year statute?
Because this claim did not accrue, and the state limitations period did not begin to run until after the FDIC sold the note. It's an ordinary note in private hands. If you go with Mr. Wolf's argument that the federal limitations period applies, you would, in essence, be creating two classes of notes in the marketplace, one set that get these extra powers because the FDIC once touched them, and
well,
another set
that
wouldn't.
Well, we've already done that, haven't we? In Jackson versus Tweed?
Not necessarily, because there was a strong federal policy.
Under those facts we did, though.
The reasoning behind Jackson, Holy Cross believes, is correct. There's a very practical policy reason for this court to do what it has done, and courts across the country have done the same. If you had a note that had, like this note, either a four-year or six-year limitations period, and FDIC acquired the bank in year four, and it took it 6 months, 2 years to sort through those notes, it would be worthless in year five, unless the next note holder got the federal limitations period.
Oh, but Mr. Wolf,
those concerns aren't present.
Why not? I don't understand why not.
Because the taxpayers already got their money. The note was in the private marketplace. The purposes behind FERIA's extension is to give the FDIC extra time to sort through the notes and to make the notes more marketable. In those situations,
well, but at the outset, everybody said, well, that just applies to the FDIC. They're the only ones that get this six-year deal, so you would have to apply them. They're the ones that are now going to sue, or still have it, can sue, and they got 6 years. But the question we're talking about now came up, and we decided it in Jackson, that it's an assignable asset, and it goes to the assignee. They get the same rights of a six-year statute. But that was based, if I understand, on the fact that the note was already in default when it got in the hands of the FDIC. Is that the distinguishing fact here that makes your argument good?
Which is the distinguishing fact?
The fact that when the FDIC got the note, that it was not in default or had not been accelerated.
In part, but the word default is used a little too loosely in some of these cases.
Mm-hmm.
The fact, for instance, in the Jackson case itself, the note was in default on the claim the creditor sought to enforce while the FDIC had the note. thus the cause of action accrued while the FDIC had the note, and the state limitations period began to run and was preempted by the federal limitations period. The point being,
if it's in accelerated state limitations and running, the FDIC gets it. They have a 6-year term by federal statute, which is assignable, so that's why the 6-year statute applies.
Yes. And the distinction is actually well illustrated by the two Federal Circuit cases Holy Cross has briefed to this court. The Fifth Circuit decision. The Fifth Circuit decision, the default occurred after FDIC sold it. Federal interests were served. There was no default. The 6-year limitations didn't apply. In Beckley, the First Circuit decision, the facts were a little more unusual. The default had occurred while the FDIC had it, but the guarantor died after the FDIC sold the note, triggering a 1-year statute of limitations for claims against estates. And the courts, both the trial court and the appellate court there, found that the state interest in its limitations period outweighed the minimal federal interest at that point. So reading those two cases together, the operative fact is whether the state limitations period began while the FDIC had the note.
Once we get past that issue, would you get to the other issue?
I'll address briefly the two issues the Court of Appeals raised for us, and that is whether they can reverse on an issue not presented to the trial court. The language of the rule is clear. They cannot. The question then becomes, was the issue of accrual presented to the trial court because it was a summary judgment based on limitations? It was not. It was, in fact, expressly agreed to by the parties. The purpose of the summary judgment rule is to let parties narrow down the issues, and if there are no questions of fact, not bother going to trial and go straight to judgment. And that's what happened in this case, and the appellate courts ought to respect the parties' decisions to narrow their issues, particularly when the record's as clear as it is in this one, that the agreement was made.
Well, is anything worth the statement that parties can't agree what the law is? That's the court's prerogative.
That's true, but in this case, what Tyler did wasn't the law. We have an affidavit from the lawyer who accelerated the note saying, I accelerated it. It's pretty clear evidence of acceleration.
No, but I mean on the part where Tyler says the parties can't agree when this action accrued because that's a legal question.
Well, let me give you an analogy. Say I sue on a breach of contract and say you breached the contract because you did not perform X, Y, and Z. You answer and say, I don't have to perform X, Y, and Z under this contract. We go to summary judgment and let the court decide. Court of Appeals reverses this because there was never consideration on the contract. It's a question of law, but we eliminated that issue at the trial court. And it may be that this court decides it wants to consider, have the appellate courts consider non-disputed questions of law, or it may not. And in a difference from that fact example than this case, how a Court of Appeals reversed us on a question of law it invented. There is no requirement that a party show posting and filing the notice of foreclosure at the courthouse to demonstrate acceleration. The court confused the requirements for foreclosure under the property code for the requirements for acceleration in the case law.
Just out of curiosity, did the Court of Appeals bring up the point of argument?
There was no oral argument. The appellant never requested it, and the appellee will never not request it again. So, in sum, there are. So, are there any more questions from the court?
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
All right.
The court is ready for your argument from this point.
And in the court. Mr. Johnny Wolf will make a statement to the court.
I wish to apologize for my lawyer not being present. I'm not sure what's happened. I believe what Tyler, the question that they raised was, what happened? Where's the evidence that a foreclosure and acceleration happened? And I believe that that's what they asked for when they remanded it back to the original court. Both lawyers had not brought up evidence that there were continuing negotiations that happened with the church and the note holder. And what I would like to see would be for that to go back to court to discuss what actually happened. I'm not speaking in correct legal terms here, but I believe that the basic question that the Court of Appeals said was that it doesn't seem to be the law here. They never addressed 4-year, 6-year statute of limitations because I believe it was irrelevant. That the church continued to negotiate after the acceleration process had started and the foreclosure process had started. There's nothing in the courthouse that stated that any legal actions happened. And there was evidence in the files that we presented to that I received from the people I bought my note from, that there was correspondence with the church discussing a payout, and there was also evidence of continued discussions for a payout. So the reason that I believe that the foreclosure and acceleration never happened was that they continued to discuss this. And that's why the note was sold again two more times. And so what I would ask for this court to do is to refuse to hear it and send it back to the original trial so that we can discuss that point that the committee, that foreclosure and acceleration never happened. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Wilton. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. It's just to sum up, the Tyler Court of Appeals made several errors in this case. One, reversing on an issue that was not expressly presented to or considered by the trial court. Two, even if they could carve out a question of law and a question of acceleration, they're wrong on the way they interpreted it. All that is necessary under Texas law is a notice of acceleration. There's case law out there that says you need a notice of acceleration and an affirmative step. As I mentioned to Justice Baker before, I believe the Courts of Appeals opinion get a little murky because of the facts in each individual case. And finally, I do believe that the federal statute does not apply because there are no federal interests to be served here whatsoever, and the state interest shouldn't be trampled when there are no federal interests to be served as well.
Anything further?
What happens if the note is accelerated and posted for foreclosure? And then the church comes forward and says, I'll make my next payment, and no foreclosure goes forward.
The statute provides for the party's ability to reaffirm the note and file that notice with the courthouse. And this happens all the time. You know, if the parties come to an agreement after acceleration, it's simple and any diligent creditor can file a written agreement with the courthouse that puts all, you know, other potential bona fide purchasers on notice, and the acceleration is undone, so to speak, if they choose to undo the acceleration instead of some other sort of payout scheme.
And what's the vehicle for doing that? If the church then makes a one-month note payment and the lender decides to work with them and not pursue the foreclosure just to put it off?
At that point, then the lender should have the trustee sign an extension of the note agreement, and that tolls the limitations period. And that's in the statute in section 16036. And it's a statute that's been around for 95 years and is put in use every day.
Anything further? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments in today's causes, and the court, Marshall will adjourn the court.
All rise.